Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yu Yunzhan, host of our monthly podcast Zhonghua Mundus that brings you recent updates about Chinese economy. Today, we would like to delve into China's innovation drive and how it compares with the U.S. on key technologies. As usual, I am with our senior fellow Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi Alicia, how are you?
Hello Yu Yun.
And joining us from DC today is Paul Triolo, partner for China and Technology Policy Lead at Albright Stonebridge Group. He advises clients in technology, financial services, and other sectors as they navigate complex political and regulatory matters in China and around the world. Paul, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Great to be here this morning and this evening.
Yes, we are across three continents to discuss this very interesting issue.
Appropriately,
exactly.
We're spanning this, given the issues.
So China has increased R&D expenditure and really improved human capital. It has made significant progress with respect to the quantity and quality of both scientific publications and patent grants. However, is this huge innovation effort fully translated into technological advancement and economic gains? Alicia, could you give us an overview of China's rise in innovation in the past decades?
Well, I'm not sure I should do that because Paul knows so much more than me that it's just embarrassing to even start this conversation. But I'm just going to make a little bit of publicity to a paper that we published at Bruegel, basically a very macro paper, which I'm sure is not going to step into anything that Paul is going to say, but this was really about innovation with a macro hat, meaning how much is put into innovation, R&D expenditure, human capital, you name it. What are the intermediate goals, industrial upgrade, patents, scientific publications, and end goals? And these end goals are mostly those that we economists care about. Total factor productivity, stuff like that. So basically, the means are huge, R&D, etc. So China is all into it. The intermediate goals are very good. Industrial upgrade, patents, you name it. It all sounds like, wow, this is going to explode productivity. But that doesn't happen. So that there's a little bit of a black box here as to why, given the means and the intermediate goals being so successful, we still don't see an increase in total factor productivity, if anything, a reduction, at least as a contribution to growth. And, you know, some people say, is this not about innovation? This is about institutions. Maybe it's too early to measure this properly. It will happen, but not yet. I mean, again, black box, it's very hard to disentangle all of these explanations. So I would leave it here, Yuyun, and that's all from my side.
Thank you, Alicia. Paul, as Alicia has mentioned, you have been a long-time watcher on China's technology. Could you tell us a little bit of how it has evolved?
Yeah, thanks. And great comments from Alicia. Yeah, I mean, I tend to look at these issues very much from a sort of, you know, company point of view and sort of individual players in these different sectors to get sort of under the hood pretty quickly. So, of course, you know, in general, China's innovation strategy had been led, of course, for a long time by the state planning. Projects like 863 and 973 used to follow those in great detail. But as we got into sort of the digital age, arguably, of course, the Chinese government allowed the private sector to sort of take the lead. I was actually in Beijing in 1995 to 1997. I saw the sort of early days of the Chinese internet, the digital economy sort of growing up. And, you know, that was largely led by small companies at the time. Eventually, you had big tech platforms like Alibaba and Baidu and Tencent and, of course, Huawei and others become major players in that sector. And, of course, the state still had a role in terms of things like the telecommunications infrastructure. But a lot of the sort of digital economy stuff was driven by private sector companies. So if we sort of look at the different areas that are of sort of key concern now, for example, in the U.S.-China relationship, which we can talk about, and you asked about things like artificial intelligence, semiconductors, green technology, you know, these are all areas with differing levels of innovation, differing levels of companies that are innovative. And but in all those areas, there are lots of really innovative Chinese companies, you know, and there's no arguing about that. And of course, some of them have received subsidies from the state to some extent. And there's a big debate now, for example, about overcapacity potentially in areas like EVs and batteries. But there's no doubt that Chinese companies are innovative. So if we look at AI, for example, there's many ways to also to compare, you know, where China and Chinese companies stand sort of globally. Again, I think it's important to note that all of these industries are very global too. There's a global piece to that. And so, you know, none of these developments that are happening in China are sort of divorced from the sort of outside world. So in AI, generally people believe, for example, that the US companies, in terms of basic research and breakthroughs, things like the transformer in GPT and ChatGPT, the T is for transformer, those are big innovations that came largely out of US companies. Although, again, in certain areas like image recognition, Chinese companies have been, AI companies have been very good and leaders and have published papers in these areas. You know, if you look at one metric, of course, is things like patents and publishing things. Chinese companies have come a long way, again, since over the last 20 years in terms of working within those systems and innovating and publishing and participating in global conferences and, you know, becoming part of the sort of the global game there. And then China for AI, for example, but China, even before the whole ChatGPT craze, Chinese companies were deploying sort of applied AI, you know, very innovatively in things like logistics on e-commerce platforms like Alibaba and Tencent and, you know, running a lot of different kinds of AI applications in the background. You might not even know, but were very innovative in deploying those for business operations, for example. And even facial recognition, Chinese companies have been leaders in that area too, for example. Although, of course, many of those companies ended up on the US Commerce Department entity list. But again, Chinese companies were arguably very innovative. Now, if we get to the age of ChatGPT, it's a more complicated mix because, again, a lot of those sort of fundamental innovations are coming from US companies. But Chinese companies like Baidu, with its Ernie bot, for example, just released a whole bunch of new data last week. You know, that the Chinese large language models, for example, and generative AI are you know, arguably slightly behind the leaders like OpenAI and ChatGPT-4, for example. And all the Chinese companies benchmark against something like ChatGPT-4, for example. But there are many Chinese companies that are very innovative in the space, including big players like Baidu, Tencent, Alibaba, Huawei. But also a lot of startups, small startups like Kaifu Li's 01.ai and Baichuan and Moonshot AI, for example. These are companies with lots of really capable engineers. They'll be over time competitive. And we're in the really early days, for example, of how companies are going to deploy some of these tools. But Chinese companies are certainly among the leaders. The problem where Chinese companies are facing big challenges is access to cutting-edge hardware and advanced compute, because, of course, the US government has chosen to cut off or restrict supplies of advanced GPUs, which are used to train these large language models, to Chinese companies over the last year and a half, 2 years. And so looking forward, that's going to also have the interesting impact of forcing Chinese companies to become more innovative and do more in those spaces. And we can talk about that. So innovation across AI, certainly Chinese companies are very competitive. And then that leads to the semiconductor piece. In part because of these controls, Chinese companies are forced to try to innovate and use their existing capabilities to do more, for example. So again, semiconductor is a complicated issue. There's, you know, design, there's manufacturing, there's tool making. And again, across those areas, Chinese companies have been very competitive. Huawei, for example, has been designing world-class semiconductors for some time. It devoted a lot of investment and energy to developing a capability to design high-end hardware and semiconductors. That's a very hard to do, by the way. It's expensive. You have to hire thousands of engineers to do that. But Huawei, before the restrictions were imposed by the U.S. government in 2020, not 2019, 2020, for example, its chip design unit, HiSilicon, was designing world-class semiconductor hardware with Qualcomm in the U.S. and Apple and other leaders. And now they've been sort of forced to redesign those chips to be built on less capable hardware. But that also comes with a certain amount of innovation and designing those semiconductors to take advantage of what you have access to. So that's going to lead to some innovation, even under the conditions where Chinese companies like Huawei don't have access to the latest and greatest semiconductor manufacturing equipment, for example. And then the area where Chinese companies have been were farthest behind turns out to be semiconductor manufacturing tools. So the tools that are used to make the semiconductors. And that's a really hard industry to break into. But again, under sort of the pressure of U.S. export controls, Chinese companies in that arena have been forced to innovate, work more with their counterparts in the industry, and work with the front-end manufacturers. So over the last 2 years, for example, Chinese toolmakers have gotten really good. They've taken market share from, for example, from U.S. toolmakers. The interesting part of the Chinese innovation is that it's also happening in this broader geopolitical context where, you know, for example, technology controls, which we'll get to, imposed by the U.S. On China are sort of forcing the industry to react in different ways. And some of that is to innovate. And then finally, you mentioned the green tech. And we can come back to all these other topics, but the green tech, arguably, you know, the Chinese government early on sort of decided that it was going to support and subsidize things like EVs and battery production. And so while the US and other countries sort of gave up on subsidies at some point in the early 2010s, China continued to subsidize that. And that led to the emergence of a number of innovative, really innovative domestic companies like BYD, like CATL in the battery space. And those companies now were global leaders. 15 of the top 20 battery companies are Chinese. Big players like CATL and CALB and smaller players that you've never heard of, like Sunwo Da and Envision. But they're very innovative. These are private sector companies that have undoubtedly benefited from some level of subsidy, but they're now, you know, global leaders. And then on the manufacturing side for EVs, for example, BYD is sort of the Tesla, this vertically integrated company, the Tesla of China. And they're very innovative. You know, I'd love to buy a BYD car, but of course, I'm not going to be able to buy one in the US for some time. But when I travel in India, I see lots of BYD cars, and they're BYD and other Chinese companies. EV companies are expanding into Europe, for example, building facilities there, both both the actual cars and also the batteries. So in the green tech space, it's hard to avoid the realization that Chinese companies dominate those sectors and the supply chain. And that's down to like the intellectual property, for example, needed to manufacture graphite anodes for batteries. The Chinese companies have a 10-year lead, for example, in that area. We work with companies that want to partner with Chinese companies in that sector. And they said this was a large Japanese company that wanted, for example, that wanted to partner with a Chinese company. And they said, hey, these guys are 10 years ahead in developing the intellectual property and the capabilities to manufacture battery grade graphite anodes, right? So it's hard to argue that Chinese companies aren't innovative in that space. All you have to do is open the paper almost every day and you'll see some new revelation about Chinese battery and car companies, EV companies expanding globally. And of course, the U.S. is trying to develop its own industry. U.S. companies are chasing the Chinese, but clearly they're very innovative in all those areas. So when you look again, compared to like 20 years ago, 25 years ago, where all the development in the S&T space and technology was all pretty much state-driven and planned by the State Planning Commission. I used to visit the State Planning Commission very often in China. And then over the last two decades, you've had particularly these high-tech areas, this sort of transition to state support for these sectors, certainly. But really the drivers are these private sector companies that have proven in most cases to be really innovative. As Alicia noted, you know, the sort of patents and all the other metrics are also show that China in the S&T arena is, of course, you know, a global leader in these areas. And translating that in the final thing I'll say is, you know, previously China couldn't translate S&T and research into actual commercial applications. But I think we're way beyond that currently, particularly in those sectors that we've talked about.
Thanks a lot, Paul. That's really like a complex picture of like how the Chinese technologies has moved up the ladder. Alicia, do you want to add anything in this area?
Yes, I fully agree with Paul that China has certainly moved up the ladder and has world champions in a number of technologies. If we look at which technologies there are, they're mainly like industrial sector. I wouldn't say they're like basic or core technologies, AI, quantum I mean, we were conducting research with patents, but we're looking at the novelty of patents and how they actually make part as, fundamental pieces of new technologies. And there, the difference between the US and China is massive for three key sectors, which happen to be those, I mean, included in our national security strategies, whether it's the US or even Europe, the economic security strategy, semiconductors, quantum, AI. And in the case of Europe, I'm not sure about the US, Paul, also biotechnology in the case of Europe. So excluding the fourth, because we haven't looked into it, but the first three, clearly, when you look at the degree of novelty, if you want quality of patents, if you want to make it simple, the US by far leads, also compared to Europe by all means and purposes. Europe only leads China for quantum out of the three. So why do I say this? Because I think the leapfrogging, basically, that China has done is mostly in sectors where, very close to the commercialization, they're very close to the industry. Is that a bad idea? Probably not, because this is how China has moved up the ladder and all of the benefits of that move. But it is a very specific, basically, model. I think China is now realizing that choke points can still be created unless they go backwards into basic research. And they're now moving ahead and doing exactly what Paul said. Yeah. I mean, like AI, et cetera, because they realize that without that, at some point, if containment is the rule, they won't be able to continue. So I think that's where China is like a crossroads, if I may say. What used to be possible as compared to a new reality where the translation between basic research and industrial advance, or is not so obvious because of mainly US containment. So I just wanted to see how you feel about this poll. So will it be easier for China? Will it be easier to continue to, or as easy?
No, but it won't be easy, right? These are all really hard technologies, and the limitations of sort of state backing are clear, right? I mean, the state can't mandate that Chinese companies be innovative in something as complicated as semiconductor manufacturing or AI. These kinds of sectors really defy the sort of any kind of state-led or state-planned effort. The state can make the environment more benign, and regulatory can affect the environment and provide some level of support. And for example, in semiconductors, one of the big innovations in that area is opening up more government research to come to specific companies in the semiconductor arena to try to leverage that government R&D more quickly to into commercial gains. But these are really hard sectors. So I absolutely agree that, I mean, that the areas like batteries and manufacturing, that's an area, of course, where China has traditionally excelled more. And so those companies that ended up emerging from that kind of level of support, they're making stuff, right? They're building cars, they're making batteries. That's this particular sort of capability capacity. Things like AI and semiconductors are a little bit different in the sense that they do require, a lots of sort of intellectual capital and to really drive those and qualified people, and the education system has to crank out a lot of really good engineers, and it takes time. Those are technologies that take us a long time to learn how to do it, right? And so for a long time, China could rely on its on purchasing the best semiconductor tool from the US or from the Netherlands or from Japan, and didn't have to worry about designing and going through all the stages that would be required to develop those tools on its own. Now they have to do that because of these restrictions, as Alicia mentioned. And so that's forcing them and those companies, for example, to think differently about their whole business model going forward. Because particularly something like semiconductor manufacturing is a very difficult, it's the hardest thing probably humans do in terms of all the different pieces you need to do that at an advanced level. And China, as I said, had mastered some pieces of that, the design part, but the many, many pieces of that supply chain that they didn't think they would have to recreate in China. Now they have to think about how to do that and where they have some advantage. The companies like Huawei, for example, can help with that. So Huawei, ironically, has sort of become this huge. It probably wasn't very aligned with the government before because, Ren Zhengfei went to Shenzhen to be away from Beijing. They were really a private sector company, and now they're sort of forced back into the arms of the government as a result of the US controls, and they're now critical to China's future development of semiconductor, the whole industry. They're doing things on many, many, many levels. I just did a paper for the American Affairs Journal that looked at sort of China's semiconductor industry policy 3.0 and how central Huawei is to that. And so, you know, it's really interesting to see how that has happened. But probably without Huawei, China would be, you know, in real trouble in terms of being able to move and try to develop despite those controls coming from the U.S. and other allies.
I find it very interesting, Paul, when you're explaining how Chinese technologies has caught up. Yes, it is traditional to have the government support the subsidy, but then you also mentioned a lot of innovative actually comes from the private sector. So then if you look at the U.S. now, given the geopolitics and the more increasing level of national security concerns into economic policy, we are also seeing a shift in the U.S., especially in the sector of semiconductor, to going towards more regulation. You have the saying of small yard, high fence approach. And could you just explain it a bit more? Is it extending to a broader area?
Sure. And I think it's important to understand that the industry in general is being buffeted by these two things, right? Industrial policy on the one hand, governments increasingly wanting to intervene, for example, in semiconductor production, in part because of the pandemic and shortages that happened during the pandemic, which really, you know, caused a lot of concern in various Western capitals. But also, for example, in the case of the U.S., concern over Taiwan. So we woke up in the early 2020s to the idea that almost 90% of the world's most advanced semiconductors were being manufactured in Taiwan by one company, TSMC. Now, the designs for those chips were largely from US companies, right? Apple, NVIDIA, AMD, and others. So the most advanced semiconductors, US companies are absolutely leaders in this. But for various complicated reasons over the last two decades, the sort of outsourcing or the delegating the manufacturing of those advanced chips to one company, TSMC, just happened to sort of validate that TSMC business model of just building other, doing really well at manufacturing and manufacturing other people's designs. That model ended up winning. And so we woke up in the 2020s, though, with this huge concentration of advanced manufacturing in Taiwan at a time of heightened geopolitical tension, which Alicia is, of course, right in the middle of in Taiwan. And so part of the U.S. industrial policy, and not just U.S., but Japan and Europe and also, was, hey, we need to diversify that manufacturing base. And so in the U.S., of course, you have the CHIPS Act, which was passed in 2020. And then just last week, the U.S. finally made the awards over the last couple of weeks, actually, has made the awards to the leading companies, in this case, Intel, TSMC, Samsung, and Micron. Big money going to those companies to build facilities in the U.S. And so the U.S. and to some extent these other countries are having to learn how to do advanced manufacturing because they let those skills erode as Asia came to dominate that manufacturing. So that's a big sort of piece of this whole equation is the so-called onshoring or friendshoring or reshoring of advanced manufacturing. And China is part of that too because, you know, those companies, for example, there are guardrails in the CHIPS Act that prevent those companies, if they have facilities in China, from investing a certain levels, for doing certain levels of investment in those facilities in China. So the CHIPS Act is very much operative here, but it's all really about Taiwan and TSMC. But that comes with a lot of problems. So just quickly, the sort of reversal of those several decades of manufacturing flowing to Asia means that costs are really high, for example, and building facilities in the U.S. now is extremely expensive. So, you know, we're talking $40 billion to build a cutting edge fab. And that involves many, many different skills. And so in the US, there's a big shortage, for example, of workforce, the trades, for example, welders, pipe fitters, and electricians. There's a big shortage. And so TSMC, for example, in Arizona had to bring in a lot of Taiwan engineers to build things like clean rooms and to install advanced lithography systems, because there just aren't companies in the US yet that can do those kinds of things. And all those companies are going to run into this. And actually, TSMC said last week, the CEO, that those chips that are made in Arizona are going to cost more than the chips that are made in Taiwan, because the economics, again, we're reversing the economics by bringing that advanced manufacturing back to the U.S. at this time in the development of the semiconductor industry. And so that's going to be a big issue. And then I think Secretary Raimondo said last month the goal of this whole effort is by 2030 to have 20% of advanced manufacturing capacity for semiconductors globally in the U.S., end to end. That means things like wafer production, manufacturing, and packaging. And that's a big problem because right now, There's 0% of those capacities. There's no advanced packaging. There's no advanced manufacturing. So it's a tall order by 2030 to get to that level. And right now, for example, the semiconductors that are manufactured in Arizona will probably mostly be shipped back to Taiwan for packaging, because most of those will require advanced packaging that's not going to necessarily be in the U.S. yet. Probably over time it will be. But it's a tricky thing. So the whole process is going to be a little painful. We might get a change in administration, and then we might get less support for this kind of industrial policy if we have a change in November, for example. And the industry is looking at that saying, you know, what is the commitment of the U.S. government to this? These are industries that require decades, a sort of decade at least, foresight to invest and keep building these capacities. So that process is happening, and the geopolitics of that are complicated around Taiwan in particular. But then, as you noted, that this the other piece the industry is being buffeted by are the technology controls. So traditionally, the industry had open markets and investments in, you know, in any country that made sense. And companies in the U.S. have had, for example, access to markets in China and other places. So now the problem is the U.S. has imposed these new controls. And you mentioned small yard, high fence. So that, just to put that in context quickly, that's part of what I've called the Sullivan Doctrine, which were statements from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan made in the fall of 2022, largely. And he talked about three things: small yard, high fence, which is a concept that had been around for a long time, controlling small numbers of technologies, but putting up, you know, big controls and high fences around them. And he also talked about maintaining an absolute lead over China in these key technology areas. A fairly major statement, because previously the informal policy had been sort of a sliding scale. U.S. companies, the U.S. government preferred U.S. companies be so many generations ahead of Chinese companies. Now the idea was an absolute lead. And then finally, and most importantly, I think, where he talked about advanced compute, biotech, which Alicia mentioned, and green tech as these three pillar sectors where the U.S. government has major national security interests. And advanced compute includes semiconductors, semiconductor manufacturing equipment, AI, quantum computing, you know, car, advanced driver assist systems, a whole bunch of areas. And in that arena, of course, U.S. companies are the leaders. In biotech, it's kind of a mixed bag. Many capable Chinese companies in the biotech sphere, BGI and WuXi AppTec, as we know recently, these are critical companies in biotech, in the biotech industry. And then, of course, in green tech, Chinese companies have, as I noted, a huge lead. So since October of 2022, this sort of small yard, high fence, and this sort of broader Sullivan Doctrine have been playing out. And of course, the problem with the small yard, high fence concept is, given that semiconductors, for example, are a global industry, almost immediately your yard is bigger than just the U.S. or the U.S. and China. It's Japan, and it's the Netherlands, and it's, you know, now it's even South Korea, because the industry is so global, and there are key pieces of it out there that are all part of the equation. So if the U.S. is trying to control tool making, for example, going into Chinese fabs, the most important tools in those fabs are made by, not by the U.S. companies, but by ASML, which is a company in the Netherlands, which makes advanced lithography gear. And so the U.S. government has tried to get countries like Netherlands and Japan to align with the controls that were first put in place in October of 2022. And that's been a really tough slog. So I read in the media sometimes that Japan and the Netherlands are on board or support the U.S. Position, but that's not really the case. They're being dragged kicking and screaming into aligning with these export controls, because the companies that are involved here are their national technology champions. And there's a big desire not to undermine the business models of those companies. And so that's been a sort of tug of war between the U.S. government and the Japanese government and the Dutch government in particular on how much of those controls can be implemented. So, for example, the U.S. controls included domestic person controls. So the U.S. companies involved, for example, in China had to pull their software engineers and hardware engineers out of those facilities in China. And that led to breaches of contract and lots of lost revenue and lots of people angry about that. The Japanese and the Dutch government, for example, want to avoid that. And their argument is a national security argument. They don't want to let other people touch their tools and potentially reverse engineer those tools if they're forced to pull their people out of those facilities, because they can't take the tools with them. You know, these are big, massive tools that cost, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And so the Dutch and Japanese government do not want to put controls, for example, on support and maintenance for those tools, which the U.S. government believes has allowed the Chinese companies like SMIC and Huawei to develop more capable semiconductors using those tools. And so we're sort of in a situation now where the U.S. government is considering more export controls on more Chinese companies, for example, a bigger yard. And the U.S. industry in particular is pushing back on this and saying, you know, this is going to undercut our revenue. We're going to have to lay off people. It's a big deal. Just last week, if you haven't seen it, and I highlighted it for Alicia in particular, the New York Fed put out a really good report on the impact of U.S. export controls on U.S. companies and the semiconductor supply chain. It's the first time, to my knowledge, that the numbers had been run on this, a sort of cost-benefit analysis of U.S. export controls on China, and particularly in looking at the tool-making side of things. And it's a really good attempt to marshal data to show, basically, the bottom line is that U.S. companies have been the big losers and lost lots of revenue, and they sort of question the national security gains here because China has been able to sort of navigate around this, at least in the short term. And so it's a pretty interesting effort, and I got a lot of my friends in industry, you know, that sent me copies and said, look at this, because this is a pretty important report. And it is, because I think it does show the complexity of policy choices, for example, on the U.S. side, when governments are interfering either on the industrial policy side or on the technology control side in a global industry like semiconductors, which has this is a very complicated set of supply chains, and where you really need to understand, you know, when you push on one part of that supply chain, what's going to happen to the overall system and what sort of the collateral damage is going to be, et cetera, et cetera. And this report was an attempt to put some numbers on that, and is very good. And so that, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the U.S. government reacts to this, because it's a first sort of cost benefit analysis of this small yard, high fence strategy and some of the other controls that have been put in place around advanced technologies like semiconductors.
Alicia, I don't know if you have seen this report, and if yes, would you like to comment on it?
I didn't. So I immediately downloaded it, so I can't claim that I've read it. But you know, I'm an economist, so I kind of could imagine how this is done. And basically the objective function here is really to say whether this is harmful for growth and exports. And yes, it is harmful. It's going to hit on certain companies exporting semiconductors, no doubt. But you know, I don't think anybody in my field as an economist can really model indispensability. I mean, you would need a counterfactual. So say, what if China retaliates against ASML itself? But the point is, it's very hard to do anything against ASML as such because of its indispensability. So the concept is, yes, companies suffer, but just imagine, yeah, that China would be able to come up with a new ASML because of lack of export controls. This is not new. You were talking about X-Vision, and many were Japanese and European companies, which lost their mojo, if I may say so, because they exported the highest end technologies on surveillance and MRI, also MRI technology. I mean, part of that is indigenous, but part of that is. So the question is, what's the counterfactual? I'm not even talking about containment, hegemony. No. I'm even talking about the companies now. So if a company knows that the company is going to be substituted, I know export controls are not there to protect companies, then. But I'm just saying that the report tends to measure the harm on the companies, but there's no counterfactual. We don't really know. Maybe some of these companies would disappear once they are not indispensable. Why? And this is happening in China all as we speak. China is substituting all legacy chips for its own. So whoever is producing, I don't know how many nanometers, I guess you can guess better than me, 14 and above, maybe 20 and above. I don't know which level of semis they're substituting, but we know is that that kind of a legacy chip environment is going to be full of overcapacity. So many companies are going to disappear. Would companies at the highest end disappear if China manages to move up the ladder? I don't know. So in other words, we're not doing this for the companies. But even if we were to argue just the argument of the paper, are the companies suffering? I still think they missed the counterfactual. We don't know what would happen were they allowed to transfer the technology. That's it.
Right. No, that's a good point. And you know, I get this a lot, which is, well, wasn't the goal originally to always to sort of eventually kick out all the foreign companies that were in a particular sector and develop alternatives domestically. I don't know that I buy that. I talk to a lot of people, for example, in the Chinese semiconductor industry. And this is, as I said, it's a very, very global industry. And Chinese companies want to be part of that global sort of division of labor. And so, they do not like the idea of being sort of cut off from the global sector. And also, if you talk to senior Chinese officials, at one point, the goal was not to sort of for China to be have a totally separate semiconductor ecosystem. They've sort of been forced into that. But if you talk to people who really understand the global industry in China, they say, hey, we realize how hard that is, that's no country wants to do that, right? Because there's so many pieces to that supply chain. And it's so it would be so costly to reproduce all of those. So the goal really was never to do that. It was to reduce dependence. There's two different things, right? One is to reduce dependence. Most countries want to reduce dependence if there's an overdependence on another country for a particular technology. The question is sort of, we'll never really know that counterfactual in this case because the controls have sort of skewed the playing field and forced China to then to take actions and policies that sort of drive towards a more self-sufficient sector in semiconductors. But given a natural development of the sector, it's not clear to me that the goal, because again, the government can't mandate that Chinese companies become innovative in this complicated area and then displace foreign companies. That has to happen sort of organically, and companies have to actually have capabilities to do that, right? And so it may have been a longer term goal to reduce dependence, but I don't really think that the goal all along was to cut off the Chinese industry from the global industry, because that there's innovation that all companies in the sector benefit from, for example. And that's a virtuous cycle that now has been disrupted by either industrial policy on one hand or export controls on the other.
I hear you that, in a sector as complex as semiconductor, especially higher end, why produce everything? But I want to say this. One of the sectors where China is probably aware that there's no point, it would be too expensive. I mean, look, just fab, if you look at TSMC, $65 billion in the US, just, it's just too much money even for China. I agree with that. But I would not push that argument too far in the sense that we've seen even with 5G, with Ericsson, with Nokia. I mean, I do think that for a country of the size of China, it's not only population, it's about industrial capacity. There is a tendency to think, and some people take this personally. I would take it technically. I would say China has the vision that it can achieve economies of scale that others cannot achieve. And that brings them very naturally, even. Let's forget about strategic competition, to integrating the value chain vertically, because they believe they can do better. And maybe they can. I mean, and a lot of these sectors, if you look at solar panels, there's hardly any exchange. It's all vertical, except for critical raw materials. So, I feel like, yes, semiconductor, you're right, is probably too much, too expensive, irreplicable. But we've seen that we thought that was the case with 5G. And, it's increasingly less the case. And it's certainly not the case for lower end, whether it's batteries or except for the raw materials. So what I'm trying to say here is that vertical integration is a trend. And that's a problem. And by the way, it's not only naturally, I want it to be very nice and I hope I managed, but not everything is natural because there's also, localization rules, yeah, for many, many sectors. Medical equipment, for example, which hits European companies massively. That's not natural, it's forced. And that's how China achieves vertical integration. So maybe the end goal is we can produce medical devices cheaper than you, so let it be. But then, what will the world produce at some point? Yeah.
Right. The rest of the world wants to do manufacturing also. Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, again, and I think it's each sector is different. And 5G is complicated because, yes, it was Huawei. Huawei was a very private sector company, which was very innovative. And the reason they grabbed such market shares because they had lots of really good RF engineers and they were very competitive. And they also had a domestic market, which was huge,
Exactly.
which had the scale. They didn't need subsidies. They could just sell to every telecom operator in China, and they'd have a huge market. But China still hasn't, by the way, shut out. Nokia and Ericsson still are still able to sell equipment in the China market at very, very within certain limits. So absolutely. But Huawei, you know, it was a weird market where there was no US competitors for various reasons, and it was really just it came down to Huawei, ZTE, Nokia, and Ericsson. And then of course again we have controls on those companies, and then that sort of alters the market. But yeah, I agree in general that in terms of industrial capacity and the way Chinese companies end up vertically integrating with government support, you get these manufacturing juggernauts that are you know that tend to you know it, certainly in PVs produce overcapacity. I think in my mind the jury's still out a bit on the legacy chip issue. I've just written a long article for CSAS on this, which I'll send you a copy of, because I think legacy is tricky because there's so many different pieces of that, and it's an intermediate product, for example, and OEMs have to actually want to buy those chips, and here the cost is not such a factor. It's a lot of it is quality and sort of long-term contracts, and so it's not that companies aren't switching legacy suppliers based on, you know, small differentials in price, and so it's a complicated sector, and there's lots of different subsectors of it that you have to look at to determine is there overcapacity in any one of these sectors. So I try to get at that in this paper because I've talked to a lot of people in industry about this, and unfortunately or fortunately, you know, now overcapacity is this big issue which the U.S. government has raised. But you know, cynically, I was talking to a number of Chinese economists yesterday. You know, there is the view that this is sort of a political thing. It's the election season in the U.S. You know, it's convenient that you know the administration that has strong support from unions, for example, in Detroit, of the auto industry, and so certainly the raising the issue of overcapacity now is, you know, is interesting the timing, but there's a little bit of cynicism about whether there really is overcapacity across the board. Certainly in PVs, historically you have had overcapacity, but you know, again, EVs and things like semiconductors, more complicated sectors. And there's evidence, there's no real data to back up the overcapacity argument at this point. And you have to really look at the demand side of it too, because particularly for things like legacy semiconductors. So in any case, it's a big issue right now because of those valid issues you raise, which is that the tendency is to for the government to support these kinds of the kind of development in these sectors that tends to then lead to overcapacity, right?
Well, I'm just very enjoying this debate right now about whether regulation is harming innovation or is actually helping the company to, you know, fend off future competitions. I have to close this episode now, so I'm going to ask each of you to give a concluding point very quickly. I'll start with you, Paul.
Yeah, I think that these issues we've talked about today are really, really important. I mean, this is sort of the U.S.-China tech competition and the fact that it draws in, you know, the whole world in some sense, is really the sort of defining issue of our times here, I think, because what we're moving towards potentially, for example, are these two different technology stacks, right? Where China and, you know, Belt and Road countries sort of have one set of technologies, and you know, it'll be complicated. It won't necessarily be, there'll be some overlap. And then, you know, Europe and the US and Asia, ex-China, like Japan and South Korea, will have sort of another technology roadmap. So we're looking at it's. I think it's better to think in terms of roadmaps because traditionally, like in the semiconductor industry, there's been a roadmap, and the roadmap everybody has signed on to that roadmap, all companies and all countries. And now we're going to have another roadmap, a sort of China-focused roadmap that's going to be different. And so you know that's the sort of world we're entering here. And then we have these. Finally, we do have this really a contentious issue that Taiwan has sort of ended up in the middle of this U.S.-China competition. And so, for example, where I work, we get every day I'm getting requests from companies to do crisis scenarios around Taiwan because Taiwan is so pivotal to all of these supply chains, whether it's green tech or biotech. You know, a lot of stuff or originates in Taiwan. And so the potential for conflict over Taiwan has become, you know, a huge obsession with companies because it's really hard to de-risk your supply chains, for example, if you at some point they have a big nexus on Taiwan. So we're constantly thinking and working on these issues and trying to understand and help companies work through all of these issues, particularly industrial policy, technology controls, and then the sort of bigger geopolitical picture. Because for companies in these spaces, it's never been more complicated to figure out what to do with your supply chains and, you know, and to reduce your risks. And it's hard to see out 3 to 5 years, given the sort of geopolitical complexities and how China will evolve and how China's leadership will think about these problems, and then how Western powers will react to different kinds of things that China could do or could potentially think of doing. And so the next 5 years in this tech, sort of geotech arena, as we've called it, the intersection of geopolitics and technology, is going to be really the place to be. And I'm very jealous of Alicia being in Taiwan, because Taiwan is such a critical and amazing place to be. I mean, it's a great people and a great country and very innovative, as we've been talking about innovation, but it's in the middle of this very complicated geopolitical tussle over the so-called technologies of the future. And the outcome of that will affect everybody, how that comes out, whether it comes out peacefully or whether we end up having, you know, God forbid, a conflict, which would be, in my view, a huge sort of failure of policy and vision to try to avoid that. But it's something that certainly in my business, I sort of live this day to day, because all the companies I work with are in Asia and have a big footprint there and are caught in the middle of all of these trends. And so thank you again for having me on the program, and very, very, very honored to be with Alicia. Is a great person to comment on all these things. And so the more informed voices on these issues that are speaking out and talking about these, the better.
Thanks so much for this time. It's been probably the longest podcast we've ever had, which means it's worthy, because it's a very this is a very contrarian view. I'm not sure you're going to like it, but I feel being in Taiwan, where everything is about technology, technological progress, innovation, you know, as an economist, I think there is an optimal level of innovation. I think it's that, like the Laffer curve, as we say, you know, and an optimal level of taxes. Same with innovation. I think the world is pushing innovation in a way that is becoming this, you know, we're kind of, it's this cutthroat competition for innovation could be very harmful, because I think if we were to slow it down a little bit, maybe, you know, we would be able to absorb it. I think part of the problem is because of the speed of innovation, which is,
right,
you know, which is making everybody fear the neighbor, because if you are cut off, what? So, you know, I'm really thinking, gosh, maybe the solution is somehow to slow it down. Somehow. I know it sounds.
No, I hear you.
But being here and how they move on crazily, it actually increases the risk. Because it's so concentrated. I mean, this place is like an atom bomb of innovation. You see what I mean? Like,
yeah. I was sitting just a couple months ago in Tainan, where all the world's GPUs, advanced GPUs, are manufactured and packaged within a mile of where I was drinking, yes, my coffee in Tainan. And, you know, that's huge, right? Because that means AI. That's where I think one of the areas of fastest innovation is AI.
Yes.
And people freak out about AI, and there's concern about the risks, and if China gets ahead on AI.
Exactly. But even an earthquake or, you know, or anything. So, you know, that idea of concentration of risk is counterintuitive. For the sake of innovation, maybe you end up, you know. So, Paul, we need to push people to be calmer on this one.
Oh, it's going to be okay. Yes. we need to figure out a way to reestablish stability and for the next 50 years and figure out a way to live with each other. Because
yes. And, you know, tell the guys in Tainan to go for a coffee with you and stop producing GPUs. You know what I mean? This is the European way to life. Because I just don't see the benefit of them.
I hear you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for joining this interesting conversation. I am Yuyun Zhan, and I am with Alicia Garcia Herrero, senior fellow here at Bruegel, and I'm also with Paul Triolo, partner at Albright Stonebridge Group. And for listeners, you can find all our research on China at Bruegel.org and sign up for our China podcast and newsletter with link in the show notes. And until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.